The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has cut off our trade with all parts of the world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. My name is Andrew Sola, and I'm at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. Today, we'll be talking about the wider political context of the Declaration of Independence with Steven Pinkus. Steven is Thomas E. Donnelly, Professor of British History at the University of Chicago. He is a specialist in empires and revolutions, and that sounds like a fun job description. He is the author of The Heart of the Declaration, The Founder's Case for Activist Government, published by Yale University Press in 2016. So, Steve, what you chose there to read out at the start was grievance number 16 in the long list of grievances in the Declaration of Independence. Now, why did you choose that particular passage from the Declaration to begin our discussion today?
Well, for two reasons. One is that it's a passage which is infrequently cited as being central to the meaning and significance of the Declaration of Independence, but also because it strikes me it captures perfectly the broader political economic vision of the founders, the Committee of Five that drafted the Declaration of Independence, and the broader transatlantic Patriot Party that was behind the ideas which were ultimately manifested in the Declaration of Independence.
Okay, well, why don't you just explain those two concepts there, the Committee of Five and the broader transatlantic party, did you say?
Yes, the Transatlantic Patriot Party. Right. The Second Continental Congress appointed a committee of five members. We generally think about the Declaration of Independence as being something written by Thomas Jefferson, but it wasn't. I mean, it was. He played a significant role, but he was one of five members of a committee that drafted the Declaration of Independence. It was a committee that involved other luminaries, including Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, among others. They worked together to draft the Declaration of Independence, but they did so in the sort of broader context of a series of political ideas that had been circulating on both sides of the Atlantic since the end of the 17th century. And one of the central assumptions of these folks was that what made colonies valuable to the British Empire was not what they produced, that is to say, not sugar, not tobacco, not rice, but what they consumed. And why was consumption so important? Because in the 17th and 18th century, the manufacturing sectors in all European countries were taking off, but particularly in Britain. Obviously, we tend to think about British textiles, but there were other things too, including the production of nails, metalworks, furniture, etc., that was being produced at much higher levels than had ever been done before. And the problem with all of this manufacturing going on is that you needed markets. You needed people to buy these manufactured goods. And in the course of the 17th and 18th centuries, almost every single European country erected new tariff barriers, making it very difficult to export goods into these places. And what patriots argued was what made the colonies valuable was that they provided a guaranteed market for British manufactured goods, not just a guaranteed market, but a dynamic market because the colonies were developing so quickly. But from the perspective of colonists, and we know this from people as diverse as the radical Samuel Adams, George Washington, who's not usually seen as a radical, they all were very concerned that were Britain to make it difficult to export manufactured goods to North America, or to put barriers for North Americans to export goods so as to get money to buy these goods, it would break down the system. And that's what they saw as having happened with the passage of the Currency Act, the passage of the Stamp Act, the passage famously of the Townsend Duties, and the physical prohibition that had been instituted by first by Prime Minister George Grenfell, but then by Lord North when Prime Minister, to actually station the British Navy to make sure that the colonies were not trading anywhere. And the argument over and over and over again of the patriots on both sides of the Atlantic was a commitment to a version of free trade, that the only possible way to make the colonies prosperous, but to make the entire empire more prosperous, was a commitment to freer trade. So at the heart, the Declaration of Independence was a claim for the free movement of both peoples and goods, and that would be the only way to sort of generate prosperity, and would also, because they argued that focusing prosperity on consumption rather than on production was also a great way to combat social inequality. That is to say, if you focused on the consumer, it meant that you were concerned that various people widespread throughout society, there would be people with the wherewithal to purchase various things. So that was also a critique. So focusing on consumption was also a critique of oligarchy.
Fascinating. I'm still not quite comfortable with this idea of the Transatlantic Patriot Party, because you said they were on both sides of the Atlantic. When one hears the word patriot, one always thinks like colonies side. So can you just describe that Transatlantic Patriot Party a little bit more?
Right. The first thing to get one's head around is that Britain in the 18th century was deeply divided politically in partisan terms. So just as we now know that, European countries and American countries are deeply divided politically, that we have highly contested elections, such was the case in Britain in the 18th century. There was kind of no narrow political elite which agreed on how to govern Britain or its colonies. From the second decade of the 18th century onwards, in Britain emerged a Patriot Party, and the Patriot Party was critical of anybody who insisted, first, that the only purpose of colonies was to extract wealth to make life better for the landed classes or the elites in Britain. They thought that the future of the empire depended on prosperity for the promoting prosperity, welfare, happiness was the term that they used for the entire imperial population. After the accession of George III in 1760, these patriots who had really kind of ascended to power in Britain in the 1750s, in the late 1750s, under the prime ministership or the ministership of William Pitt the Elder, they were kind of thrown into the wilderness by George III, because George III, his own political instincts were very sympathetic to the sort of Tory party. And Pitt and his co-ministerial partner, the Duke of Newcastle, were thrown out of office, and they were replaced first by George III's private tutor, who was also a Tory, the Earl of Bute, but then by a series of Tory ministers, starting with George Grenville, but mostly during the period that we're interested in, Frederick Lord North, who had an incredible Tory background. So the Patriots were thrown into the political wilderness, but that didn't mean that they didn't have a political purchase in Britain itself. So there was a significant Patriot Party in Parliament associated with a whole range of people, including the Duke of Richmond, Colonel Barre, after whom Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania is named, John Wilkes himself. There were a number of these people who were in Parliament, but they had an even broader purchase in Britain outside of Parliament. But they also had supporters throughout the empire. There were patriots absolutely in North America, like Benjamin Franklin, like Samuel Adams, but also patriots in Jamaica, patriots in Ireland. And it's important to realize that the volunteer movement in Ireland, which happened during the American Revolution, they were led by Irish patriots who absolutely identified themselves as part of this Patriot Party. There were patriots in Scotland who were very critical of some of the positions that were taking place. And there were patriots even in British India. So, for example, the newspaper Hickey's Calcutta Gazette that was published in India during the American Revolution was very much a self-identified patriot newspaper. So there was a global patriot movement of which the North Americans were a subset. Now, saying all that leads to the kind of question, why did the patriots in North America ultimately call for breaking from the British Empire, where other patriots remained within? And the answer, I think, has to do and can be traced fairly easily in the very quick transition from something like the Fairfax Resolves, adopted in Fairfax County, Virginia in 1774, and the Fairfax Resolves, including the participation of, you know, major figures like George Washington, that were very critical of the political economic policies being adopted by Frederick Lord North's government, critical of the Stamp Act, critical of the Townsend duties, critical of the Tea Act, all of this stuff. But what they called for was imperial reform and insisted that they were loyal to the British Empire. And they called upon George III to reform the empire. In their view, in 1774, and this was a position which was absolutely paralleled by the famous Jamaican petition of 1772, which also called for similar imperial reform, sounded very much like the Fairfax Resolves. In both cases, what they imagined that George III was somehow a neutral arbiter over the empire and would govern the empire as a whole, and therefore would limit what they saw as the excesses of what they kept on referring to as the English Parliament. But between 1774 and 1776, it was no longer possible to maintain that fiction. George III revealed himself to be extremely hostile to American criticism, and as several of American patriots, but also British patriots, pointed out, George III acted not as a king of the British Empire, a ruler of the British Empire, but as a king of England, narrowly as a king of England, which explains why in 1774 in the Fairfax Resolve, the patriots called for George III to act on their behalf. And by 1776, they began by saying that...
Calling him a tyrant.
By calling him a tyrant, yes.
And other yeah. Nasty words.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. The word patriot, in the context that you've been using it, has kind of just totally shifted something in my brain. Because as an American, you grow up thinking that patriot just really means one thing.
Right.
You have to be anti-King George, anti-British, pro-American person. And yet now you're saying, well, actually, the word patriot doesn't have that context at all. In fact, there were English patriots as well.
That's right. Absolutely.
In that wonderful summary you just gave me, you mentioned a bunch of things that I'd just like you to quickly remind us about. You mentioned the Stamp Act and the Townsend Acts, as well as the Fairfax Resolves. Can you just quickly go through those three things in whatever order, Stamp Act, Townsend Act, and the Fairfax Resolves, and just explain what those key terms are, because they'll come up again in this series at some time.
Absolutely. So let me first sort of provide you with the context, right?
Yes.
In 1763, so George III had been king for under 3 years. The Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, came to an end. The French and Indian War, or the Seven Years' War, was in fact a global struggle between the French and the British empires. It was fought, yes, in North America, but it was also fought in India. It was fought in continental Europe. It was fought in the Caribbean. And it was a more expensive war than any European power had ever faced. And the result was to make the three main imperial participants, that is to say, the British Empire, the French Empire, and the Spanish Empire, they ended the war in massive debt, right? I mean, huge national, what we would call national debts. All three empires struggled to figure out how to pay down that debt. And there were a bunch of fiscal experiments. In Britain, there was a very lively debate about how best to pay down the debt. One group associated very closely with the Tory party in Britain argued the best way to pay down the debt was, on one hand, to pursue austerity measures at home, not to spend money on new programs, on new infrastructure, or anything like that to save money, but also to get the colonies, which were perceived to be extremely wealthy, the colonists, to pay what they thought of as their fair share, or to pay down the debt, and with the notion that the colonies hadn't been paying sufficient taxes before. or any taxes in their view. The other view associated with the Patriots was, no, these guys have got it all wrong. Yes, we have a big national debt, and yes, we should pay it down, but the best way to pay this down would be to stimulate growth in the economy, the imperial economy, and to expand trade, and that would help to pay down the debt by generating massive customs revenue from foreign trade, and using that those resources, you could pay down the debt. And these patriots also argued that by far the most dynamic part of the British economy in the late 18th century were the colonies. So the last thing you wanted to do is to tax the colonies directly. You wanted to increase their buying power. You wanted to stimulate growth in the because that was the most dynamic sector of the economy. So that was the context. George III appointed Tories to ministerial offices. George Grenville, who was one of these Tory prime ministers in 1765, hit on the notion of a Stamp Act on the colonies as a way to raise money. Now, what does the Stamp Act do? The Stamp Act says that for all sorts of printed, official printed and unofficial printed documents, you had to pay a licensing fee to put a stamp on them. And this included newspapers, but most importantly, all legal documents. So any legal document had to pay a stamp fee. Anytime you bought or sold land, you had to pay a stamp fee. The colonists, North American colonists, but it's important to realize that this was true in the Caribbean as well. The Stamp Act was to be applied to the Caribbean as well. There were protests throughout not just the future 13 colonies, but all 26 North American colonies. Why? Because there was very little specie, money, cash, to go around. And the insistence on the Stamp Act was in the Stamp Act was that these taxes be paid in coin, not in kind, that you couldn't, you know, pay the taxes by giving the government, you know, a cow or some tobacco or something like that. You actually had to pay in coin. And their argument was, well, if we do that, then we're not going to be able to buy British manufactured goods, goods which were necessary, you know, not only to clothe ourselves, but to build houses, to build tools, to farm, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a huge protest on those grounds. The result ultimately in 1765-6 was that Grenville's government fell and was replaced by a government by Rockingham, was one of the only patriot or patriot sympathetic governments that was appointed in 1765-1766. They repealed the Stamp Act, and then George III got rid of them. And it's important to realize, though, that in 1765-1766, the opposition to the Stamp Act, everybody knows about colonial opposition to the Stamp Act, certainly North American opposition to the Stamp Act, and there was, as I said, significant opposition in places like Jamaica, but what's understated is how significant opposition there was to the Stamp Act in Britain itself, especially in manufacturing areas.
What was their argument from that perspective?
Well, their argument was the same as the colonists, that exacting a Stamp Act on the colonies would mean that the colonists didn't have the money to buy British manufactured goods, so that the effect of the Stamp Act would be to massively increase unemployment in the manufacturing areas of Britain, places like Manchester, Birmingham, etc. And so
it would reduce demand for
these manufactured goods. It would therefore unemploy all these people working, you know, in textile factories, in metalware factories, et cetera, et cetera.
Which might lead to its own form of unrest in Britain.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you want to carry on with the context? We're getting from the Stamp Act to the Townshend and then to the Fairfax resolves. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah. So the Townshend duties. So one of the arguments that was advanced by the colonists against the Stamp Act was the British Imperial Parliament has perfectly every right to regulate external relations of the colonies, but not to regulate the internal regulations of in the colonies. That each assembly, each colonial assembly, had the right to tax its own people, the residents in the particular colonies. And that was where the origin of the term no taxation without representation. In other words, the taxes only could be levied in places where people were actually voting on the taxes. So the assemblies can do this. And there's a long history of the sort of no taxation without representation arguments in the British Isles.
And let me just quickly jump in here and correct me if I'm wrong, but each of the colonies had its own, underneath the British Empire, had its own form of assembly and state government.
That's
colonial
right.
Government.
Each, with the exception of Canada, yes.
Right.
I mean, each of them had their own assembly, just as it should be said, Ireland had its own parliament, right? I mean, so this was an argument which was also advanced in Ireland. So the solution that the Townsend brothers, both Charles Townsend, who we know as the Chancellor of the Exchequer in Britain, and his brother George Townsend, who was then the Viceroy of Ireland, the solution that they had was, okay, we won't regulate internal affairs, the taxes internal to the colonies. What we'll do is we'll pass a series of duties on what we see as sort of luxury goods that all of the colonists are going to buy, and we'll raise that up so that won't be interfering with their internal taxation. That is to say, the stamps were administered in each colony, and there was a stamp officer associated in each colony. We would simply have duties of the goods coming into the colony that would take place outside of the colony, and therefore we wouldn't be violating their internal affairs. So they raised these duties, but the effect was the same. The duties had to be paid in cash, I mean in specie, and the duties were on a whole range of goods that most colonists felt they needed to buy.
Quick question. You used the word duty. In what sense is this not a tariff?
Right. It is a tariff. That's precisely right. And that's exactly why the cutting off our trade with all parts of the world comes in, right? I mean, that is to say, what the effect was George III here in the Townsend duties was making it difficult for the Americans to trade with Britain. But of course, a lot of these goods were not just British goods. But yes, I mean that's absolutely right. It was a complaint about the exertion of these tariffs. But the tariffs, and this is what's extremely important, is that we talk about the Stamp Act, the Townsend duties, as a kind of litany of things that we all talk about having happened, which is absolutely right. But there was a kind of set of enforcement mechanisms which were non-fiscal as well, right? I mean, that George III instituted new admiralty courts to be set up in America to try people for violation or smuggling goods in to avoid various forms of duties, right? But more importantly still, he stationed the Royal Navy to prevent trade between the British colonies and French colonies or Spanish colonies. So traditionally, the Caribbean and the new British colonies the new British colony of West Florida gained after the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War in 1763, the whole value of West Florida would be to trade with Spanish America, right? I mean, that's Pensacola was seen as an ideal port to trade with Spanish America. So George Grenville stationed the British fleet, a large portion of the British fleet, right outside Pensacola to make sure there would be no trade with Spanish America. So this is another way in which he cut off trade with all of the world. So it was a series of tariff barriers and prohibitions with trade with other countries.
Wow, that's fascinating. Okay, so that's the Townsend Act. And now maybe, again, just quickly now to get us back to the Fairfax.
Right, the Fairfax results, right. I mean, so the Townsend duties included duties on tea. And, famously, New Englanders upset about these duties on tea threw large portions of the tea coming into Boston Harbor from the East India Company. The tea was grown in India, threw the tea into Boston Harbor, and the British government reacted with all sorts of punitive, I mean, the famous Boston Port Act, but all sorts of other punitive measures This led to a series of protests throughout the North American colonies, the creation, famously, of the Committees of Correspondence. And one manifestation of that was a very set of people throughout the colonies, but famously in Virginia, adopting resolutions complaining of British government policy. And the 1774 Fairfax Resolves were one set of these resolutions. They're particularly interesting because they were very well advertised, in part because they involved people who were normally associated or significantly associated with the American Revolution, like George Washington, like Patrick Henry. But what's significant about these is that they were how typical they were of the complaints of the colonists. They complained largely about these political economic measures, the prevention of trade with the rest of the world, with these duties, with these sort of political economic policies. But what they called for in 1774 throughout the colonies was not for independence, but for radical imperial reform. So the puzzle that, you know, historians need to ask is, why did those who called for imperial reform and insist upon their loyalty to the British Empire, which the Fairfax Resolves did repeatedly, the authors of the why did they go from 1774 saying that to 1776 adopting a Declaration of Independence?
Right, and indeed, maybe that's time that we start looking at that. I'm just trying to get now a sense of the different groups, sort of political groupings. Now let's just focus on the colonies. So you have the Patriot Party, these, and then presumably there's a group of colonists who basically are totally in lockstep with King George of the Tories.
Right.
But then now this Patriot Party starts having its own internal struggles. Yeah. And then you get, we might say, a more extremist wing that does want to move towards more radical reform in the direction of independence. And then there's the other group that's like, well, you know, maybe it'll, for a number of reasons, mostly because if you go in the direction of basically revolution, rebellion, and independence, you're putting a target on your head. So maybe just out of self-interest, you're like, okay, well, let me go in the direction back to King George and loyalism. Is that roughly accurate?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I would say that there's, even among these groups, I mean, even among the Patriots, there's a split, which I think we insufficiently appreciate, between those who thought that British imperial government was ipso facto a bad thing and had always been a bad thing, and those who insisted that no, the British Empire had actually been a very good thing for its colonies and for the colonists in particular until the very recent past. And so here, I mean, one way to sort of describe this is the sort of argument between somebody like Tom Paine, who in Common Sense said, it made no sense ever for Britain to govern America. They're two different continents. And Britain, by the way, is governed by a monarchy. Monarchies are always bad. You know, the argument for independence is clear and had always existed, right? And so it's just a question of breaking away. There's that position, and then there was the position of somebody like John Adams, who said, no, actually the British Empire was a really great empire. We were right in the 1750s to be such enthusiastic supporters of the British Empire against the French. The British Empire was really a much better thing. It was an empire of liberty, whereas the French were an empire of tyranny. But something dramatically changed after 1763. And so there were these two poles. And you can see by that language with which we started that the history of the present King of Great Britain, not the kings of Great Britain, the present King of Great Britain, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations that the Committee of Five ended up siding with John Adams rather than with Thomas Paine.
Interesting. Yeah, and I hadn't looked at that very careful wordage there. The present king. I'd never noticed that, but indeed it's a time-specific complaint.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And remembering that the present king of Great Britain mm-hmm. only took the throne in 1760 with the death of his grandfather, George II.
Yeah, fascinating. Great. You know, there's this big economic message here. To what extent is the common colonist focused on maybe these weighty matters of duties and economy and this and that. I mean, is it really only a pretty much an elite group of colonists who are doing this, or are we talking that this is something that your average everyday colonist is worried about?
What was it that Carville said famously, right? It's the economy, stupid. The reality is that the economic effects of these various policies were felt universally, right, throughout the colonies, right down the social scale. It's not just a set of elites, right? Now, that said, in the 18th century, just like in the 21st century, people perceive and feel an economic reality, right? I mean, people realize when the price of eggs goes up, famously, right? But why did the question is why did the price of eggs go up? And the answer to that question is a political question, right? Mm-hmm. So, there was no question that there was extremely widespread agitation. I mean, the Stamp Act provoked riots and discontent in every single colony. Every single colony, not just the 13 colonies that would become independent. I mean, it's famously the Halifax Gazette was far more critical of the Stamp Act in language than some of the newspapers from, say, South Carolina. So there was widespread discontent. There were riots, demonstrations against the Stamp Act everywhere. And these were not just political elites. These were not riots led by, you know, the wealthiest or those most affected, although they clearly were involved. But they also it also kind of polarized opinion. So to give you an example, somebody like John Wentworth, the governor of New Hampshire, was certainly somebody, I mean, he's from an old New Hampshire family who was, you know, during the Revolutionary War, a loyalist, somebody who eventually became the governor of Nova Scotia, right? He was roundly critical of the Stamp Act. And he was roundly critical of the Stamp Act because he said it made it very difficult for people in the province of New Hampshire to live, to buy things, et cetera, et cetera. And he was also critical of the Townshend duties. But for somebody like Wentworth, this meant that one should do everything one could to promote imperial reform. But he drew the line at independence, right? And so you could imagine that line being a line very, very difficult to cross. But one should realize that over the course, with the Townshend duties affecting all these people, it created popular and local resistance among people from a wide social class of people, that these committees of correspondence, which emerged in response to the Townshend duties in each and every colony, as well as, it should be said, in Britain itself, complaining about what was going on, didn't just involve the wealthiest people. It involved, I mean, certainly, you know, community leaders were involved in most cases, but it involved people who were quite modest in their incomes. And it should be said that this issue of calling for imperial reform but not wanting to break away from the empire, you know, that was also something that was felt by people, a set of sentiments that were felt by people quite far down the social scale, and also involved some of the calculations of Native American groups. That is to say that the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois, some of their leaders said, look, the British Empire has been good for us. They've defended us against the French. You know, yes, we don't like some of these taxes. Yes, we don't like the fact that some of these sort of British governors treat Indians badly. But in general, we're not going to sort of go in favor of independence, which is why some of them fought on that side. And so this was felt fairly far down the social scale. But again, this should hardly be surprising. And I guess one of the things that I want to sort of emphasize is that newspapers were widely available throughout the North American colonies. Literacy rates in the North American colonies, including those that, you know, didn't plump for independence, extremely high.
What do you mean high? What are we thinking?
We're in the cities, we're sort of talking about over 70%, right?
I mean, really high.
Yeah, really
historically high. Speaking, yeah.
Historically speaking, extremely high. I mean, when I say 70%, we're talking about cities and towns.
Yeah.
We're not talking about the countryside. But yes, very high level of literacy rates and an extremely high level of political information, which is available to them, right? I mean, that in a lot of the colonies, the press was tilted overwhelmingly to what I've called the sort of trans-imperial patriot position, but other positions, more royalist positions or more Tory positions, were also available in the press. And there were nuances of these various positions. So there was a lot of political information that was about. And it's important to sort of contrast this to the kind of political information that was available in the other European empires, right? I mean, you have no newspapers circulating in the Spanish Empire until after the American Revolution, right? Until after the American Revolution, you similarly have very limited amount of press being available in the French Empire in the Caribbean, right? So this is, it's an unusually politicized and politically aware population. So that's why I feel confident in saying that these issues touch very deep down into the population, not just that the economic effects were felt widely, ubiquitously, but that the wherewithal to sort of think about why these economic effects were happening, there was the political information to analyze that.
Fascinating. Thank you. So in order to sum up everything we've been talking about in just a couple of words, your argument is that the Declaration of Independence is a pro-free trade document.
Free trade. I mean, I want to...
I mean, that's a modern term, but can we just say that?
I would say pro-commercial. And let me just say that it's important when we talk about free trade, or at least when some people talk about free trade, they imply the sort of lack of state involvement in the economy, right? I mean, free trade is the absence of state involvement. These guys didn't want, they knew that the state had to be involved in the economy. They knew that you needed the Royal Navy, for example, to protect trade, right? The state needed to support trade. They knew in the North American case that up until the accession of George III, the British government had been providing substantial bounties for the development of various goods in North America, in the Caribbean, etc. They weren't opposed to any of that, right? They also knew that the state was involved in regulating the quality of goods. They weren't opposed to that either, whereas somebody who's a free trader now might well be opposed to some sort of consumer affairs bureau, which is in favor of regulating quality and protecting the consumer. So they weren't interested in consumer protection law. But what they didn't want was they didn't want tariff barriers preventing the importation or exportation of American goods. They didn't want the Navy being used instead of to promote trade. They didn't want it being used to prevent trade. So in that sense, I mean, they used the word free trade. That's what they meant by free trade.
Yeah, and that's a loose meaning of free trade that I think we can all kind of understand now. And again, I just want to stress the point that I made earlier, that this patriot free trade concept also had its advocates in Britain, because they knew
that
clamping down on trade across the Atlantic Ocean would have negative consequences also in the factory towns of England. So I just put a pin in that, because I want to move on to one final kind of big subject today. You've argued, as we see, that there's this pro-free trade agenda in the Declaration. And also, I thought it was interesting, as we were communicating before this interview, you said that the Declaration was a pro-immigrant document. Yes. So can I just have you read that? I have it down as grievance number 7.
Yes. Right. So George III has endeavored to prevent the population of these states, for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither, and raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands.
Wow. What the heck's going on?
Right. I mean, so again, one of the things that I was suggesting is that from a patriot perspective, what makes for a dynamic economy is a lively consumer base. And of course, consumers are people, right? And you want more people. I mean, there was a sort of prior set of arguments that they made, right? I mean, so John Locke had famously argued in the 17th century in the two treatises of government that property was not something that God created. what created property, what made property, was human labor, human work, right? And which meant that the more humans you had to labor, the more property, the more prosperity, the more happiness you were going to have. And so the argument of the patriots was that you want to populate the colonies with as many people as possible. And they were complaining that George III had limited migration into the colonies to prevent the population of these states, and made it difficult by making it harder for foreigners to naturalize, to become British subjects or British citizens. And significantly and interestingly, the patriots and the authors of the Declaration of Independence correctly noted that up until the accession of George III, there had been significant support from the British imperial state to encourage migration. And George III had reversed that policy. And they felt that such encouragement was necessary to guarantee the dynamic growth, the dynamic prosperity of the colonies.
But just wait, before we get on. So this naturalization of foreigners.
Yes.
So all people born in the colonies, or Europeans, I guess we should say, became British citizens. But you could go to the colonies from a non-British imperial place, and after, what, 5, 7, or a certain number of years, or instantaneously just say, I am no longer a citizen of X, yeah. But now I am...
Exactly. It was very easy. Right. So there were huge, you know, significant migration from parts of Germany, from French speakers, meaning that there were people not just from France, but from places like what's now Belgium, coming to the colonies. There were significant migrants from Spanish and Portuguese speaking places. All of these people, should they come, it had been up until the 1760s very easy for them to become naturalized. And it was very easy for them to buy land, if should they choose to buy land. And what had happened under George III's government was a series of prohibitions for Europeans to migrate, and made it much more difficult for them to naturalize, to become British subjects or citizens. And
it's subjects, yeah. I think we should use the word subjects. I realize I made a big mistake there referring to these people as citizens, because even in their own countries, they might not have had any legal status at all.
Well, right. They have. Right. I mean, it's useful to think of them as subjects, but it's also important to realize at some level they're citizens in the narrow sense that citizens are people who live in cities and have rights as members of cities. So that's part of what's going on here, is that they're also, you know, if you move to Charleston, the argument was you could be naturalized and have the full rights of a citizen of Charleston, South Carolina, in that kind of very specific sense. In other words, to vote in local elections, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's important to sort of use, I mean, I want to use the words both subjects and citizens, because I think one is specific to sort of local rights, one's sort of thinking about imperial status. But yes, and it's important to realize, I mean, so some of these debates also involved significant Jewish population. So we know that there were Jewish populations, for example, various sort of Jewish merchants, both Sephardic and Ashkenazi, who moved into the colonies and in Jamaica, in the Carolinas, in New England, in New York. And Britain had, the British government in the 1740s had passed, well, 1730s and 1740s, had begun passing naturalization laws, making it easier for Jews particularly to naturalize as British subjects in the colonies. And then there was a big debate in the 1750s whether those naturalization rights for the colonies would be allowed in Britain itself, in which they initially passed them saying yes, they would be, and then they rejected them in a sort of big debate over the so-called Jewish Naturalization Act. But Jews in the colonies, Jews could naturalize as British subjects. All of these abilities of people to naturalize as British subjects became increasingly difficult through a series of executive acts that took place in the 1760s and 1770s. And it should be said that part of the target of the Stamp Act in 1765, that is to say, having to pay taxes on the conveyance of land by having to buy a stamp to purchase land, was targeted in part making it much more difficult for new immigrants to purchase land. So that was part of where the authors of the Declaration said raising the conditions of new appropriations of lands, that involved things like the Stamp Act.
Fascinating. So yeah, there are kind of four separate little points in that passage. The first was he has endeavored to prevent the population of these states. And I'm really happy now that that very much connects with the famous line from the Declaration of Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. If they're associating happiness with population growth, yes, then of course you are decreasing our happiness or preventing us from being happy by preventing the states from growing in population. So that's, I think, for me, a huge point. The second passage here says, for that purpose, obstructing the laws for naturalization of foreigners. So this is what you were talking about. King George III is making it more difficult for, say, Jews or people from the Spanish colonies or French-speaking world to become subjects slash citizens. The fourth one was raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. So we were talking about the Stamp Act, making all of these transactions more difficult. But maybe then just clarify this third passage, refusing to pass others to encourage their migrations hither.
Right.
What does so, that mean?
Yeah. So from the late 17th century onwards, the British government had done all sorts of things to encourage, to subsidize, to organize, to promote migration to the colonies in the Atlantic world. And all of that came to an end. I mean, in a number of cases, I mean, we know, for example, populating of Nova Scotia after the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, or before the end of that, that is to say, before the end of the war, the British government sort of committed to subsidize the migration of people to Nova Scotia. And that these involved most of the migrants who came from German-speaking areas. But they were subsidized in the sense that both that their passage over was paid for, and they were also kind of given startup costs. You know, for a year or two, you'll have startup costs. And these kinds of subsidies for immigration were widely deployed in different areas for different moments to populate the colonies. By 1763, all of these kind of subsidies had come to an end.
Okay. Well, that really helps us understand grievance number 7 about preventing the population of the states. And also, you really did a fantastic job explaining grievance 16, cutting off trade with all parts of the world, and why that was such an important piece of this puzzle we have of understanding the Declaration of Independence 250 years from now. So as just we get to the end, for me, what struck me as fascinating about this discussion is basically how you started it and the links that we've created throughout this conversation between the things going on 250 years ago and what's happening today. So thinking of after this big war, the French and Indian War, the British government is worried about its high national debt. And, you know, the United States, after 20 plus years in Iraq and Afghanistan, some economists have said it's a $6 trillion war, all costs going out into the future. You know, you're like, oh, yeah, what do governments do when they have a huge national debt like the U.S. does? Well, some people advocate austerity, others advocate growth, and this leads to political division. So, like, you know, everything is new, and yet nothing is new. Secondly, tariffs. You know, yes, different arguments about tariffs in the political realm and about the economy. Third, issues about immigration. Does immigration increase our prosperity or happiness or not?
Right.
All of this has to do with divided politics. And we kind of get the sense that this political division that we see today, we've also had 250 years ago. And I think maybe the fifth point, we didn't cover this quite as much, but it was interesting to see that there was a global perspective on what's happening in the world. There was sympathy amongst colonies, maybe the Irish and the Bermudans and the Indians and the Americans and the Canadians all agreed to certain things about what was fair and what was not fair. So those were my takeaways from this discussion. But I just want to give you the last word here, Steve. You're a scholar of the Declaration. You've been studying this all your life. Here we are 250 years later. What do you think are the most important lessons people in America and around the world should remember when we look at this document?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've done a very good job of kind of highlighting the sort of larger perspective. I mean, I suppose to my mind, what's remarkable about the Patriot position is precisely one which insisted that the colonists and then the newly independent Americans had to operate in a world, that they were globalists in a very real sense, not in the sense of, you know, support, you know, I mean, globalization wasn't a thing, but they thought they needed to interact with other peoples in the world. They were not autarkic. Independence did not mean separating from Europe. It meant engaging with Europe in a new set of ways as an independent polity. But they imagined one in which trade would be absolutely central to that. They imagined one where immigration would be absolutely central to their place in the world. And what they were trying to do in the Declaration, and I think it's useful to think about the Declaration as a constitutional document. That is to say, it's the first American constitutional document. Then there were the Articles of Confederation. Then there was the Federal Constitution. But in that constitutional document, it outlined a set of ways that Americans should interact with the world. And provoked, yes, by very similar issues which, you know, we have been facing in the 20th and 21st centuries, but they took very specific positions on this. They thought the way to make the United States prosperous and happy was to trade with the world, to invite immigrants, and, you know, I mean, the other elements of this, to insist on independent branches of government, right? That they didn't want judges to be dependent on the will of the monarch alone, for example, that these kinds of balances were important, but that all of this fit into a sort of broader idea of what I call a sort of political economic system. I mean, we've talked about the economic, but there were sort of political prerequisites, I mean, narrowly political, traditionally political prerequisites, which went into making this vision for the economy possible.
Steven Pinkus from the University of Chicago. That was really great. I had a lot of fun and learned a lot too. Thanks.
That was fun.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.